This COE is based on the decisions released by our appellate courts in August of 2019 addressing issues related to civil procedure. The summaries of those decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in August of 2019, and they were subsequently organized in an update pamphlet. And it is that update pamphlet which constitutes the written materials for this CLE. And the page numbers, the page references, are to the pages in that August 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. First case is Lake Harbor Advisors on page 6. It deals with an arbitration issue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that under the terms of the employment contract, even if the matter involves both arbitrable and non-arbitrable claims, any court procedure should be stayed until the determination of the arbitrable claims. The court wrote, where arbitrable and non-arbitrable claims are inextricably interwoven, the proper course is to stay judicial proceedings pending completion of the arbitration, particularly where the determination of issues in arbitration may well dispose of the non-arbitrable matters. Next is Matter of Sammy F. It's on page 7. It's in Article 78. It has to do with the proper procedure for attempting to expunge a youthful offender's DNA records. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gish, reversing Supreme Court, held 1. An Article 78 mandamus action seeking the expungement of the petitioner youthful offender's DNA records from the data bank was properly brought. And 2, a judge has the discretion to expunge a youthful offender's DNA records. The petitioner voluntarily provided a DNA sample before he was adjudicated a youthful offender, and Supreme Court had held it did not have the discretion to expunge the records. The court wrote, we hold that the same discretion afforded to a court under the executive law to expunge DNA profiles and related records when a conviction is vacated may also be exercised where, as here, a youthful offender disposition replaces a criminal conviction. Next is Matter of Piagentini. It's on page 8. It's another Article 78, this time brought by crime victims attempting to influence a parole decision. Third Department determined that the wife of a police officer murdered in 1971 did not, as a crime victim, have standing to bring an Article 78 proceeding challenging the release on parole of Herman Bell, who was convicted of the murder. Crime victims do not have standing to challenge a parole determination. Next is Anonymous versus Gleason on page 10. It has to do with raising an issue for the first time in an answer to a summary judgment motion, and also with the criteria for amending a complaint. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant doctor's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should have been granted. Instead of answering the defendant's expert opinion that the doctor's actions were not the cause of the amniotic fluid embolism, which plaintiff alleged caused the death of plaintiff's decedent, the plaintiff, for the first time, alleged the cause of death was septic shock, not amniotic fluid embolism. Supreme Court erroneously denied defendant's motion for summary judgment and allowed plaintiff to amend the complaint to allege the new theory. The court wrote, a plaintiff cannot, for the first time in opposition to a motion for summary judgment, raise a new or materially different theory of recovery against a party from those pleaded in the complaint and the bill of particulars. And with regard to the amendment of the complaint, the court wrote, once discovery has been completed and the case has been certified as ready for trial, a party will not be permitted to amend the bill of particulars except upon a showing of special and extraordinary circumstances. Here, the plaintiff failed to show special and extraordinary circumstances in seeking leave to amend the complaint and the bill of particulars in response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment 3 years after the commencement of the action and almost 6 months after the filing of the note of issue. The plaintiff offered no reasonable excuse for relying solely on the medical examiner's report and for failing to explore his new theory of causation earlier in the proceedings. Permitting the amendment at this late stage would prejudice the defendant. Next is Greater Buffalo Accident and Injury Chiropractic. It's on page 11. And it deals with the sufficiency of pleading prima facie tort. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint did not state a cause of action for prima facie tort. The court said, prima facie tort affords a remedy for the infliction of intentional harm resulting in damage without excuse or justification by an act or series of acts which would otherwise be lawful. The requisite elements of a cause of action for prima facie tort are 1. Intentional infliction of harm, 2. Which results in special damages, 3. Without any excuse or justification, and 4. By an act or series of acts which would otherwise be lawful. The court wrote, here the prima facie tort cause of action cannot stand because, although the complaint alleged that defendant acted maliciously and with disinterested malice, it did not allege that defendant's sole motivation was disinterested malevolence. In addition, the complaint failed to allege special damages as required. Next is Medical Care of Western New York on pages 11 and 12. It deals with the pleading requirements for breach of contract, negligent hiring and supervision, and prima facie tort. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff did not state a valid cause of action against the insurer for breach of contract, negligent hiring and supervision, and prima facie tort. The claims were paid by the defendant insurer, and plaintiff alleged flaws and delays in the processing of the claims. The court wrote, the amended complaint failed to identify the specific insurance contracts that plaintiff had performed services under or the contract provisions that defendant allegedly breached. A bare legal conclusion without factual support is insufficient to withstand a motion to dismiss. We conclude that the amended complaint fails to state a cause of action for breach of contract. Turning to the negligent hiring or supervision, the court wrote, although an employer may be liable for a claim of negligent hiring or supervision if an employee commits an independent act of negligence outside the scope of employment, and the employer was aware of, or reasonably should have foreseen, the employee's propensity to commit the act, the amended complaint failed to allege that the acts of defendant's employees were committed independent of defendant's instruction or outside the scope of employment. And finally, with respect to prima facie tort, the court said there can be no recovery for prima facie tort unless a disinterested malevolence to injure a plaintiff constitutes the sole motivation for the defendant's otherwise lawful act. The amended complaint alleged defendant acted in bad faith and intentionally caused harm, but those conclusory allegations failed to state that the defendant had a malicious motive unmixed with any other and exclusively directed to the injury and damage of the plaintiff. Furthermore, it is a critical element of prima facie tort that plaintiff suffered specific and measurable loss. Next is Matter of Pease on pages 12 and 13. It deals with the Theory of Judicial Estoppel, Second Department, Reversing Supreme Court, held the doctrines of judicial estoppel and collateral estoppel precluded family court from finding father did not have standing to seek custody of a child. Father had previously been deemed a parent in the context of parental access. The definition of parent is the same in the context of custody, the court said. In the prior appeal, this court expressly stated that the father had standing to proceed as Isabella's parent under Domestic Relations Law Section 70 based upon the doctrine of judicial estoppel. As the term parent has the same definition under Domestic Relations Law Section 70, whether the party is seeking custody or parental access. It is immaterial that our prior determination did not specifically mention custody when it concluded that the father had standing to seek parental access with Isabella. Since the mother is judicially estopped from arguing that the father is not Isabella's parent under Domestic Relations Law Section 70, the father was free to seek custody under Domestic Relations Law Section 70 as Isabella's parent with co-equal rights to the mother. Next is the Rezk case. It's R-E-Z-K on page 13. It has to do with the requirements of bringing a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute. Second Department, Reversing Supreme Court, held that the court did not have authority to dismiss the medical malpractice action pursuant to CPLR 3216 for failure to prosecute in the absence of a 90-day notice. The court further noted that although dismissal for failure to comply with discovery demands was not warranted, the preclusion of further discovery was appropriate in this case. The court wrote, with regard to CPLR 3216, the courts have no authority to dismiss an action for failure to prosecute, whether on the ground of general delay or for failure to serve and file a note of issue, unless there has first been served a 90-day notice. Here it is undisputed that neither the Supreme Court nor the defendant served the requisite 90-day notice upon the plaintiff. With regard to the discovery, the court wrote, dismissal of the complaint pursuant to CPLR 3126, subdivision 3, was unwarranted as a sanction for the plaintiff's failure to limit his disclosure demands. The remedy of dismissal is only warranted where there has been a clear showing that the failure to comply with discovery demands was willful and contumacious. The sanction of dismissal is available for the willful and contumacious failure to disclose, which did not occur here. The plaintiff submitted to a deposition by the defendant. However, the lengthy pendency of this action, the dispute over plaintiff's overbroad demands for disclosure, and his refusal to tailor those demands in accordance with prior orders of the court compels the conclusion that further disclosure has been forfeited. Next is the Kainer case, K-A-I-N-E-R, on page 14. It deals with the foreign non-conveniens theory. The First Department held that a lawsuit to determine ownership of a Degas painting illegally confiscated by the Nazis and years later sold at a Christie's auction in New York was properly dismissed on forum non-conveniens grounds. The plaintiff's rights arose in Germany and France, and Swiss and French estate law apply. The court said, the motion court properly dismissed this action on forum non conveniens grounds without first determining whether it had personal jurisdiction over all the defendants. Then it cites a case which is at 549 U.S. 422 and says that that case is persuasive authority on this point. In that case, a unanimous United States Supreme Court held that a trial court has discretion to respond at once to a defendant's forum non conveniens plea and need not take up first any other threshold objection. In particular, a court need not resolve whether it has authority to adjudicate the cause, that being subject matter jurisdiction, or personal jurisdiction over the defendant, if it determines that in any event a foreign tribunal is plainly the more suitable arbiter of the merits of the case. If a court can readily determine that it lacks personal jurisdiction over a defendant, the proper course is to dismiss on that ground. However, where personal jurisdiction is difficult to determine, and forum non conveniens considerations clearly militate in favor of dismissal, a court may dismiss on that ground. The burden on the New York court in applying Swiss and French estate law to determine the underlying issue of the lawful heirs to the owner's estate is significant. As the motion court noted, the parties not only dispute the applicable foreign law, but discuss the substance of the law in a manner that is at best opaque. The applicability of foreign law is an important consideration in determining a foreign nonconvenience motion and weighs in favor of dismissal. Next is the Prima Pacific Partners case on page 15, another forum nonconvenience case. First Department held a dispute involving Goldman Sachs Singapore was properly dismissed on forum nonconvenience grounds. The court said, the action was properly dismissed on forum nonconvenience grounds, given the unduly burdensome inquiry involved in determining personal jurisdiction. The decision whether the court had jurisdiction over Goldman Sachs Singapore, because Goldman Sachs Singapore was a mere department of the New York-based Goldman Sachs Group, would involve an arduous inquiry. Plaintiff's causes of action for fraud and breach of fiduciary duty lack a substantial nexus with New York. Plaintiff is a Cayman Islands partnership, not a New York resident. Malaysia has a greater interest than New York in whether one Malaysian bank corruptly took over another Malaysian bank. Next is the Onkalata case on pages 15 and 16. It has to do with the rule that requires an affirmation demonstrating to the court that good faith efforts had been made to resolve the issues before seeking the court's jurisdiction. The Second Department determined Supreme Court was not required to deny defendant's motion to compel plaintiff to submit to a vocational exam in this labor law personal injury action because defense counsel did not submit a separate affirmation demonstrating a good faith effort to resolve the dispute. The good faith effort requirements of 22 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, Section 202.7, Subdivision C, were met in the primary affirmation submitted in support of the motion. While it may be better practice for the movement to detail good faith efforts in an affirmation separate from the affirmation addressing the merits of the motion, the requirements of 22 New York Code of Rules and Regulations 202.7c were satisfied by the primary affirmation of counsel submitted in support of the motion, where the counsel detailed her efforts to obtain plaintiff's compliance with the court order. In another good faith efforts case, Bronstein on pages 16 and 17, Second Department held defendant's cross motion for sanctions pursuant to CPLR 3126 relating to disclosure should not have been granted. The cross motion was not accompanied by defense counsel's affirmation demonstrating a good faith effort to resolve the issues addressed by the motion. The court wrote, pursuant to 22 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, Section 202.7A and C, a motion relating to disclosure must be accompanied by an affirmation from moving counsel attesting to a good faith effort to resolve the issues raised in the motion, including the time, place, and nature of the consultation, as well as the issues discussed. Here, the affirmation of good faith submitted by the defendant's counsel in support of the cross motion for sanctions pursuant to CPLR 3126 failed to provide any detail of the claimed efforts to resolve the issues. Next is the Best case, which is on page 20. It has to do with jurisdictional discovery. Fourth Department held the plaintiff was entitled to jurisdictional discovery with regard to a hospital defendant in this medical malpractice action. The court noted that the hospital did not consent to the general jurisdiction of New York courts by registering as a foreign corporation with the Department of State, and the defendant doctors did not consent to New York personal jurisdiction based upon becoming licensed to practice medicine in New York. The court wrote, plaintiff made a sufficient start in establishing personal jurisdiction over the hospital pursuant to CPLR 301 and 302A1 to be entitled to disclosure pursuant to CPLR 3212 subdivision F. The record is not clear whether the hospital's affiliations with the state of New York are so continuous and systematic as to render it essentially at home in the state as required for general jurisdiction, or whether its activities in New York are purposeful and whether there is a substantial relationship between the transaction and the claim asserted as required for long-arm jurisdiction. However, the record contains evidence that the hospital advertises to prospective New York patients and has at least some relationship with New York providers, New York insurers, and defendant Guthrie Medical Group, which owns New York offices. The record also contains evidence that the hospital derives substantial revenue from New York residents. Based on that initial showing, we conclude that plaintiff has made a sufficient start by establishing that facts may exist to exercise personal jurisdiction over the hospital, warranting jurisdictional discovery. Next is the U.S. Bank case on page 21. It's a foreclosure action, and it has to do with the required proof of compliance with the notice provisions of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, section 1304. The Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, held the bank did not demonstrate compliance with the Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304 notice provisions and failed to submit sufficient proof of a lost note in this foreclosure action. With regard to the notice, the proof of notice under Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law section 1304, the court wrote, proper service of the Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law section 1304 notice containing the statutorily mandated content is a condition precedent to the commencement of a foreclosure action. The plaintiff failed to submit an affidavit of service or any proof of mailing by the post office demonstrating that it properly served the defendant pursuant to the terms of the statute. Contrary to plaintiff's contention, the affidavit of a representative of its loan servicer was insufficient to establish that the notice was sent to the defendant in the manner required by Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304, as the representative did not provide evidence of a standard office mailing procedure and provided no independent evidence of actual mailing. Next is the Petion case, P-E-T-I-O-N, on page 22. It has to do with the substitution of parties. It also deals with the relation back doctrine. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's protracted delay in substituting father for the deceased infant in this medical malpractice action did not require dismissal of the complaint because the defendants were in possession of all the relevant medical records and therefore were not prejudiced by the delay. The court wrote, CPLR 1021 requires a motion for substitution to be made within a reasonable time, and the determination of whether the timing is reasonable requires consideration of several factors, including the diligence of the party seeking substitution, the prejudice to other parties, and whether the party to be substituted has shown that the action or defense has potential merit. Although the plaintiffs admit that the delay in seeking the substitution of the administrator was protracted, the plaintiffs showed that there was no prejudice to the defendants because the defendants were on notice of the claims against them as early as February 2009 when the plaintiffs filed a notice of claim against the defendant New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, and the defendants possessed all of the relevant medical records. The plaintiffs also demonstrated that they have potentially meritorious causes of action through their expert's affidavit of merit, the pleadings, and the testimony of Marie Petion at the General Municipal Law Section 50H hearing. Next is Walton on page 24. It deals with a motion to renew Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held the motion to renew should not have been granted. The dissenters argued the motion could have been considered a motion to re-argue in the exercise of discretion. The court said, it is well settled that a motion for leave to renew must be based upon new facts that were unavailable at the time of the original motion and that would change the prior determination. That's CPLR 2221E2. The court went on, although a court has discretion to grant renewal in the interest of justice upon facts which were known to the movement at the time the original motion was made, it may not exercise that discretion unless the movement establishes a reasonable justification for the failure to present those facts in the prior motion. In particular, leave to renew is not warranted where the factual material adduced in connection with the subsequent motion is merely cumulative with respect to the factual material submitted in connection with the original motion. Next is Rodriguez. On page 25, it deals with the savings provision, CPLR 205 subdivision A. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the medical malpractice wrongful death action should not have been dismissed because the letters of administration were issued within 6 months of the prior dismissal. The argument that Supreme Court used the wrong date to calculate the six-month period for refiling a lawsuit pursuant to CPLR 205A could be raised for the first time on appeal. The court said, on appeal, plaintiff argues for the first time that the prior action was finally terminated when the October 2016 order granting the hospital's motion was issued, so that the court used the wrong date to calculate when the six-month savings period under CPLR 205A began to run. We will consider this argument since it raises a legal question appearing on the face of the record which could not have been avoided. While plaintiff, as voluntary administrator, lacked the legal capacity to enforce decedent's personal injury and wrongful death claims on behalf of the estate in the second action, that's pursuant to Surrogates Court Procedure Act, Section 13063, he could remedy this defect by obtaining letters of administration within the six-month savings period provided under CPLR 205A. In applying CPLR 205A, we bear in mind that it is designed to ameliorate the potentially harsh consequence of applying a limitations period where the defending party has had timely notice of the action. Because the first action was finally terminated on October 18, 2016, and the letters of administration were issued on April 18, 2017, on the last day of the six-month savings period, plaintiff timely obtained legal capacity to pursue the claims in this action. Next is the DITEC or DTEC case on page 27. It deals with the application of the six-year statute of limitations in foreclosure actions. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the mortgage was not accelerated until the foreclosure action was commenced in October 2016. Therefore, the action was not time-barred, except for the mortgage payments due but not paid more than 6 years prior to October 2016. That being the missed payments prior to October 2010. The court wrote, contrary to the defendant's contention, he did not establish that the complaint should be dismissed on statute of limitations grounds through the notices sent to the defendant in February 2009 and May 2009, as those notices did not accelerate the mortgage. The notices indicated that acceleration was a possible future event, but did not constitute an exercise of the mortgage's acceleration clause. Rather, the mortgage was only accelerated in October 2016 when the plaintiff served the foreclosure complaint on the defendant seeking immediate payment of the balance of the principal indebtedness. The court went on, whereas here the mortgage was payable in installments, there are separate causes of action for each installment accrued, and the statute of limitations begins to run on the date each installment becomes due. Therefore, since the plaintiff alleged defendant made his last payment on the mortgage in January 2009, and this action was not commenced until October 6, 2016, the defendant established that any unpaid installments of the mortgage, which accrued before the six-year period prior to plaintiff's commencement of the foreclosure action, that being unpaid installments from January 20, 2009 through October 2010, are time barred. So any of the payments that weren't made prior to 6 years before the action was commenced are time barred. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be put on your attorney affirmation for this August 2019 Criminal Procedure Update CLE. The affirmation code is TRANSIT. Again, the affirmation code for this August Civil Procedure 2019 Update CLE is TRANSIT. So the final case in this CLE is the Williams case on pages 31 and 32. It deals with a motion to set aside the verdict, and it just illustrates the criteria for such a motion. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the substantial plaintiff's verdict in this wrongful death case should have been set aside. It was alleged that the New York State Transit Authority was negligent in failing to make sure all passengers were off the subway train when the train reached the end of the line, requiring that it be repositioned in the relay tunnel. Plaintiff's decedent, who was intoxicated, remained on the train. At some point, he fell from the train in the relay tunnel and was killed. The court said, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, there is no valid line of reasoning and permissible inferences which could possibly lead rational people to conclude that the defendant's alleged negligence was a proximate cause of the decedent's injuries and death. Even assuming that the defendant's employees were negligent in failing to remove the decedent from the train before it was taken into the relay tunnel, the defendant's negligence merely furnished the condition or occasion for the occurrence of the decedent's fall from the train, rather than being one of its proximate causes. While the record evidence supports the plaintiff's theory that the decedent was in the area between the two northernmost subway cars when he fell to the tracks below, the circumstances that led the decedent to be in that area and the cause of the fall itself remain unknown and therefore speculative. That concludes the August 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE.